Well, good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. Thank you all for coming out tonight. We've filled the room. It's wonderful for you all to be here for celebration of the publication of Janet Groth's The Receptionist, An Education at the New Yorker, published by Algonquin Books. I'm happy to let you know, I just learned before we started this evening, that the book is now in its fourth printing. First, before we introduce our two speakers, may I ask that you take a moment, and if you have a cell phone or a pager or a laptop or anything that's going to beep or make any kind of sound, take it out and just turn it off. And we will be recording this evening, so it also benefits not only those of you in the room seeing this event live, but people who will watch it on the internet. This is the time of the year when we ask our members to support our annual fund. The money that we do raise is critical to special events like the one tonight in our members' room, to all the things we do, running the children's library, building a great collection of books, and our ever-popular book discussion groups. As head librarian, I want to thank you all for supporting this so far, and for those of you who are still waiting, there's lots of time to help us by the end of the year, so please do so. We have copies of The Receptionist for sale tonight, and the corner bookstore are outside, and they're happy to sell you one after the event, and I know that Janet will be happy to sign one for you. You would be right to think that being a librarian at a place like the Society Library means that many, many interesting books cross my desk. Do I have time to read them all? Well, if truth be told, it is the rarest of weekends when I actually get to settle down for a whole day and devour a book in one sitting. Janet's book, The Receptionist, is one that I did this very thing with. I cracked it open early one Sunday morning. I'm embarrassed to tell you at what hour I started, but I read it one Sunday morning and sat on my couch and devoured it by the end of the afternoon. I enjoyed it very, very much. For 21 years, Janet Groth was the 18th floor receptionist at the New Yorker. She rubbed elbows with many literary luminaries that you'll be hearing about tonight. But I would also argue that this wonderful book is as much a story of Janet's journey in life, and it's a very interesting journey, and tonight you'll have an opportunity to hear more about her journey. There's some really beautiful writing in the pages, so do read it. We are also really pleased and thrilled to have back with us library member Mark Singer, and he's here to talk with Janet. Mark is a longtime member of the library, and as many of you know, one of the regular Talk of the Town columnists at the New Yorker. They did cross paths at the New Yorker. They'll be telling you more about this during the evening, but I really thank Mark for coming and helping us provide the evening for you. We will have time for questions and answers following their conversation, so please join me in a warm welcome to Mark Singer and Janet Groth.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to talk. We're going to have a conversation, and we'll see where it goes. A couple of caveats. We have this audiovisual equipment ready, and we might get around to using it. We might not. It's not here as a sort of
not
device
a tease.
To distraction.
No,
not a tease.
Not a tease.
But we'll see where the conversation goes. The other thing is, when I was working with you, you were Jan, so you're Janet as an author. And
only in my later life.
Okay.
I'm Jan.
So if I slip into Jan, that's you'll excuse me. Now, this book is a lot of things, which is what I think attracts the readers to it. It draws on so many potential groups of readers. My friend Elizabeth Charlotte, my great friend Elizabeth Charlotte, who published this book, is here tonight. And when she first told me about it, she said that really what made her want to publish it was that it was an emblematic story of a woman, young woman, coming to New York, which it obviously is. And what I admire so much about it is its honesty. I mean, I spent my whole life as a reporter of doing whatever I can to avoid writing about myself. And when I'm in a conversation, I always want to be the one asking the questions. And you've opened up here in a way that's remarkable. And I want to know, when did you know you were writing this book? What sort of book did you really imagine at the beginning you were going to write? And what did you... Start with that, and we'll evolve from that. Go ahead.
Well, it began as a phony book, a novel, the novel that my professor, Morgan Bloom, said that I was writing with a cigarette holder.
Which he didn't mean as a compliment, as I recall.
He did not. He led me to trash that particular novel. Fortunately, I kept the blue notebooks that had all the raw data in them and trailed them around with me wherever I went. And at the time that I finished sort of plumbing the life of Edmund Wilson, right down to his last romantic encounter with Edna St. Vincent Millay, I thought, well, I have to go somewhere now. Where am I going to go? My collaborator, David Castronovo, has gone on to the blokes, the bad boys of British literature, Amos and Larkin and all those wonderful guys in Britain. What am I going to do? And I looked at those blue notebooks, and that's when I realized that actually they had the makings of an interesting memoir. That was the beginning. That was 2005.
2005. So, but you did start writing this in the sense that you kept notes. It sounds to me, from your descriptions of rooms, descriptions of meals, descriptions of ships that you've sailed on and places that you've been in your travels, mm-hmm. I assume you were a compulsive journal keeper.
That's pretty much true. And... I blessed the day that I had those because they provided the raw material, the archive
right.
that I was plumbing.
Right. I mean, a writer's life is supposed to be an experience, certainly for a novelist, it's supposed to be his or her capital, but I'm not a journal keeper. And so I think actually it only is capital if you preserved it. So I've let all that... go because
bless
I don't think I want
those blue notebooks.
So those are in blue notebooks and they're still in your possession somewhere.
Yes.
And now maybe there's another book in them even.
Maybe there is.
Okay. But in the meanwhile, this book, I think it, among other things, it's clearly, as I said, emblematic of a certain kind of experience at a certain time. You arrived in 1957. You'd gotten a B.A. that spring at the
yes.
University of Minnesota.
Actually, it was that August I had to take a summer course to finish the B.A. in three years in a summer. But that's another story. It was a little sibling rivalry with my brother who had gotten or always held it over my head that he had gotten his B.A. in 3 years and why couldn't I? And he later confessed to me that he had 45 credits from the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay. Didn't play fair. But you started working there in the fall. What month do you recall?
September. So, I remember it well.
Okay. So you really went directly. You went from Minnesota to New York City.
Pretty much.
And how much time had you spent in New York before that?
Well, I came out on one of those yellow buses that Lillian Ross wrote about, the high school junior year trip.
Mm-hmm.
My high school newspaper sponsored a trip to Washington and New York, and I had been there and looked at the situation and discovered it wonderful, every bit as wonderful as the movies that I had seen as a child. It started with the aerial views of lower New York.
Which you described because your family actually, yeah. your parents ran a movie theater.
There you are.
So you literally watched those images of New York. That really resonates with me. I grew up in the Midwest also. I didn't see New York until I went away to college. And I have a distinct memory of my freshman year in college being at the... Waldorf Astoria, Thanksgiving weekend. I wasn't going home to Oklahoma. I was there with a friend and two sisters, and we were at the Waldorf, and I would like to be able to check this. I think our rooms cost $25 a night.
Did you stay far away from the room service or the little refrigerator?
Well, we didn't touch any of that stuff. But what I really remember is coming out onto Park Avenue on a Saturday or Sunday morning, looking at the Pan Am building, what was then the Pan Am building, and feeling that this city would eat me alive. I will never, ever live here. I might not ever set foot here again. When I came to the New Yorker a few years later, as a talk of the town reporter, it was against odds. You had a very different experience. Also, I never planned to be a writer. That was not a dream of mine. Your book is about a dream. Your book is about what happens in a dream and to a dream, and it's a dream that keeps being reviewed and revisited by you throughout. So do you see it that way?
It starts with an essay which I hoped would be taken as a short story, which I entered in the Mademoiselle contest, and I called it Night Thoughts. It is excruciating. It's sensitivity. That's all it is. It's just a series of angst-ridden thoughts of the teenager who is watching the ephemeral headlights of a car sweep across the bedroom ceiling and be gone forever. I didn't win that Mademoiselle short story contest. Sylvia Plath won it that year.
But the dream was to be a writer.
Yeah.
That to me is really I wouldn't want to have drawn those cards of wanting to be a writer or wanting to be anything, because I think that's really setting the bar very high for oneself. I'm most impressed, not by people, forgive me, but not by those of us who come from the Midwest and come to New York, which I thought was easy. Did everything was new for me. Everything was fresh, and I wasn't jaded. You felt that way too. You're the least jaded person I think I know, and you still seem that way.
What can I say? It digs deep, that Minnesota stuff and the Minnesota nice, and the let's say if you start in the northern parts of Iowa, it's even deeper.
So all of those true cliches, which are unavoidable, because people really do treat each other with a certain outward politeness and concern. And of course, one of the reasons we all leave those places is because we've grown up in places where they're populated by the most vicious gossips, and really to no useful purpose. But you were leaving some of that too. But what I was really thinking of is that for people who grow up in New York, the average privileged New York adolescent wanting to be a writer, wanting to be a photographer, wanting to be a dancer, all that to me is a much taller order, because you're starting off with a disadvantage of knowing that your friend's parents secretly hope that you'll fail so that their child will succeed.
And sure, they've been through the whole Holden Caulfield scene and the Wendy Wasserman and
Washington. That's right. So, but you came here as this Wasserstein, Wendy Wasserstein.
Thank you.
But you came here as this ingenue.
Yeah, I guess that was easy. Certainly, I was naive, and I took up residence with one of the people who was in the room tonight, 1957, the Studio Club on 3rd Avenue, just off 77th Street, just down the street from McCabe Liquor. Not that we knew anything about that liquor store, but the YWCA branch that was called the Studio Club was sort of the poor man's Barbizon, where Grace Kelly lived when she came to New York, and that's where I lived when I became the ingenue.
How long did you live there?
Well, I guess it was from September until the following the following summer and or spring, and I took up a sublet with one of the New Yorker talk reporters, Anthony Bailey. He later became a wonderful writer about Rembrandt and other mm-hmm. other painters. Mm-hmm. And he and Margot were having their sort of starter one-bedroom apartment on off Central Park West on 75th Street, and wanted a sublet for the summer, and my British roommate and I took it and left the Studio Club then.
Mm-hmm. This is a really pedestrian question, but I literally want to know, the first day that you went to work at the New Yorker, what did you do? And what did you... Do you remember what you were thinking when you showed up here?
I thought, can they possibly be paying me to sit at this desk in nowhere? I mean, it was down on the 18th floor. At that time, there were roughly six other offices there besides the office of the fashion department. My friend Elizabeth Geyer, who is now Elizabeth Geyer Ebel, is here tonight. She can attest to exactly how many other people were there. Robert Gurdy, a couple of other editors were there, and maybe Jack Flagler and a few other writers. And they had this desk somewhere in the off the elevators, and I had this yellow pad that said, "While you were out." And literally all I had to do all day long from 10 until 6 was to write down the name of the person who had a call and the person who had called them. Had I gone to the University of Minnesota and become a cum laude English department, major for that? Well, maybe.
For the moment, that was it. And you didn't know how long that moment was going to last.
That's right.
But... I'm thinking of two Calvin Trillin anecdotes. First of all, he's the person who described those offices most aptly. He said that it looked like the back office of a failing insurance company, is what he said. And also,
or maybe Excite Battery, who did used to occupy the end of the hall.
Who's that?
Excite Battery. Truly, they were on the 18th floor before the...
Co-tenants, in other words.
Pardon?
Co-tenants, in other words.
Yes.
I miss them. And
well, so did Bud. He didn't come until after we were expanded.
No, he came in the early 60s.
That's right.
I came in 1974, so you and I overlap by four mm-hmm. years. Bud kept on his bulletin board, which ended up actually in the Smithsonian. When we moved our offices out of that... ode to joy, everyone here. When we moved our offices from 25 West 43rd to 20 West 43rd, they needed a sort of a quintessential New Yorker writer's office, and his was the one that was chosen to be taken.
Terribly afraid. I call his corduroy couch cover brown, and Bud swears it's blue, and then I have to go to the Smithsonian and check it out.
Did you discuss the number of babies that were conceived on that couch when you spoke?
Well, but mostly it was used by doddering old Mr. O'Leary, who he was past conception, I think.
Okay. When I got there, I didn't remember. Bud was rarely in the office, but somebody was, because I remember hearing him. Somebody. Anyway, I'll come back to that, I think. He also had a phone message. It couldn't have been taken by you. Certainly, you were on your lunch hour, and it was while you were out, who called? He was planning a trip to Italy with his wife, and so the person who called was Ali Talia. Did that come up the other night when you...
Not me, but I did have to remind him that I was on the Lexington Avenue bus one time when his pal oh, gosh, I've forgotten his name again, but he said, you're Jan, aren't you? I'm Fred Butts. And, of course, he was the friend of Bud's, who had been talking in a noisy airport and wanted to leave a message for Bud, and became forever after, between the two of us, Fred Butts.
So you get there, and you immediately begin meeting everyone, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
And when did you begin to feel that you were connected to the people there?
Well, I think maybe I paid my dues in the art department. The 6-month stint in the cartoon section of the magazine, when I was not a receptionist any longer, but and not really the assistant to the art director, James Garrity, but who was Don Hull, and he was the one who went through all of the sort of over-the-transom, unsolicited cartoons and found literally one in a million, I think. There were 30,000 coming a day or a week, or just everybody who ever had any time to spend at their desks were drawing a cartoon for the New Yorker and sending it in. Mm. And somebody had to look at them and send them back with a rejection slip. And Don Hull did the first culling, shall we say, and I was the assistant to Don Hull, the assistant to the assistant. And while I was up there, I had an exposure to the wonderful artists who came through the New Yorker, Saul Steinberg and Charles Adams and Charles Saxon and Ed Koren, fabulous, fabulous artists. Mm-hmm. And when I came back from my first vacation and discovered that Mr. Garrity had, in the meanwhile, perhaps discovered that I was being too sympathetic or not right or somehow or other I wasn't his cup of tea. And he suggested that an earlier assistant had come back, and therefore I would be going back down to the 18th
right.
floor. Well, when I went back down to the 18th floor, I somehow retained that patina of the person who was not just a receptionist, but an editorial assistant.
Well,
and then I thought I belonged.
Well, I think I showed up there, and you belonged a lot more than I did. You were there, and I have to say that, you know, who was it that described the New Yorker as basically staffed by congenital unemployables?
Well, I give A.J. Liebling that line, but other people say it was Rogers Whitaker. And so we agree to disagree and give both of them the possibility of
there was a lot of latitude given for idiosyncrasy. That's for certain.
And I always loved that about the place. It was great.
And when did you realize that certain people were not merely idiosyncratic, but nuts? And talk about some of them. Feel free.
Well, let me see. You know, St. Clair McKelvey was a wonderful writer, but it's true that he had a bad case of what we now call bipolar disorder. And when he was in a manic phase, he would sometimes come in and scrawl really objectionable words and logos on the wall, and those had to be scrubbed down before we began work that day. So that often took kind of, it gave me a sense that Mr. McKelvey was a person to be treated with respect. I don't know how to say this exactly, but he was one of the oddities that they undoubtedly thought of.
What did you literally do when he was? Were you present when he was doing this?
He would write me little scribbles and nothing objectionable. Just and actually one of the stories I tell in the book is of a wonderful cocktail party that he threw when he was in a manic phase. He had maybe 30, 40 people at this cocktail party. He had it catered by white jacketed waiters. He had a suite of rooms covered in chintz at the Hotel Adam, which was right down the street mm-hmm. from the Hotel Stanhope. And Most of the literati from his day were there. He was celebrating one of his books, The Edinburgh Caper, and it was at that particular cocktail party that I ran afoul of Dorothy Parker.
Oh yes, tell that story. I think you come off better in this than she does. So tell
us. Mrs. Parker was on the other side of the room, and so it wasn't until most of the people had left this cocktail party. I must tell you that it happened in about 1962, I think, and everybody was smoking, and the waiters were passing nothing but real drinks, Manhattans and martinis and straight scotches. There wasn't a glass of wine to be found. And are you talking about seltzer? No. These were all people who had learned to drink in the 20s, and they were still either drying out or drinking, and they smoked. And the waiters had only Ritz crackers with a little bit of cheese on top and maybe an olive, and people somehow managed to have a cigarette and a match and a martini and a Ritz cracker with an olive, and they never spilled anything. I don't know how it worked out, but eventually at about a quarter after eight, the room was clearing, and there were people gathered at a couch on the other side of the room around a little woman with a dark dress and a white lace collar and tight permed hair, and I gathered that this was the legendary Dorothy Parker. And there was a place, she was sitting next to her poodle, and there was a place next to the poodle that was unoccupied. I had been standing at this party on my high heels for 2.5 hours, and I just went over and took it. I just was it's true, I was shy, but I took it. And I said something nice to her about having enjoyed her work, and she muttered something, but she had these glassy, sort of permanently teary eyes, and her head drooped forward on her little white lace collar, and the poodle was looking longingly at the coffee table where there was an open box of dog biscuits. So I took one and I said, "Want a biscuit, Cliché?" That was his name.
Cliché.
And her head flew up. She looked at me through these icy, teary eyes, and she said, "It's not a biscuit, it's a bicky. Who do you think you are, Henry James?" So I felt that I had been honored. I'd been put down by the queen of the game.
You got that's a great dividend. I was walking into situations like that very often myself early on. With William Shawn, the editor of the magazine, who invented uncomfortable politesse. He was a very truly shy man, and when one would go see Mr. Shawn, that there was always an eagerness to put him at ease, so that one would not be ill at ease oneself. And I sort of found the approach that worked best for me was just to sort of treat him as if he were my fellow Kiwanian or something, and just...
Well, I'm sure that was really brilliant of you, and in fact...
I don't think so.
Pauline... Well, I don't know. Pauline Kael pretty much cowed him, you know, by treating him as if he were a fellow dock worker out at... in the San Francisco Bay Area that she had started in.
Well, she was in a contest to see what words she could get in the magazine that he was not going to have in the magazine.
She bullied him into quite a few.
Well, maybe certain words, but there were others that I know didn't make the cut.
And many long paeans to Warren Beatty and other people that she liked.
Well, in any event, going back to this business of again, this theme of a dream. Because you've gone to New York, you've come to this place, you're surrounded by these luminaries, you're speaking with them every day, you feel part of that place, and you're befriended by a number of them. You become very close friends with Muriel Spark, for instance, and a lot of other staff writers. You know, Henry Cooper has you for Christmas dinner, and you befriend, you know, Ved Mehta, who's here tonight, and so you're enjoying this. I don't know, what is that? You're up. You're in this swim of things.
Intimacy, I guess, of a kind, a family feeling.
It's a family feeling. Did the dream change for you?
Well, it certainly put off a sense of drive that I might have had as a person for whom walls had gone up, that I might have felt some sort of sense of pride of battering through. As it was, I seemed already to have been admitted into the inner circles in some sense, and maybe I didn't want to test that by actually submitting my manuscript.
Because there were only three things. There were only three times
right.
in
That's
your
right.
from 1957 to 78, you submitted three things to the magazine.
That's true. A poem to Howard Moss. It was a poem, by the way, about a candlelight parade on Fifth Avenue, one of those anti-Vietnam marches.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very sweet. He wrote a handwritten note to me. It was not designed to discourage me from never submitting a poem again, yet I never submitted a poem again. And I sent Burton Bernstein a little news break, and Bert wrote me a nice note and said, try again.
News breaks were the little things at the bottom of the columns that were fillers, that
were typographical right.
errors, and then there would be a tagline. And Bert Bernstein was writing those for quite a while, but he inherited that from
E.B.
White. Mm-hmm. And we no longer have those, or very, very rarely.
And the third thing was the one that sort of, I don't know who it tells most about or against or for. I wrote a talk story, which I was quite proud of, about an MLA, a Modern Language Association conference that had been held in the Hilton Hotel. The talk of the town had covered Modern Language Association events because they had such funny talks by people who were in English departments across the country, and they might use a lot of jargon that was funny. And I had written about that particular MLA conference, sent it upstairs, and then I heard nothing. And I waited another week, and I waited another week, and maybe in the third week after I'd sent it upstairs, I called Mary Painter, who was then Mr. Shawn's secretary, and I said, I wondered if Mr. Shawn had had time to look at my talk story. And she said, oh, I don't seem to remember that. Let me have a look around. And she found it at the bottom of a stack of papers on his desk, which clearly hadn't been seen. And she said, it's no use anyway, because it's not timely anymore.
Well, that is a very poignant story. And
but there are writers throughout the magazine who have overcome much higher hurdles than that. I just allowed it to defeat me.
Well, there's all kinds of mythology about the New Yorker, and the thing about myths, of course, is that they acquire a truth of their own, regardless of what the actual facts might be. But and yes, Mr. Shawn was a genius of some sort. I think that was generally acknowledged. What was underappreciated was the degree to which his diffidence, his shyness, was actually a way of controlling people and a way of using his authority, which was absolute around there. And you would be told when something was rejected, well, we just felt that it didn't work this or that way, and we was the editorial we. It was one person, but it's literally true that talk stories could get lost forever. And I, when I read that in your book, I thought, oh my God, that must have been devastating. Did you feel it that way at the time?
I pretty much did. I tell about a couple of other opportunities for promotion that were met with more overt obstacles. That is, I don't count really Dorothy Morrison's invitation to me to join the goings-on about town calendar, where I would have been stuck in some little office in the back of the 19th right. floor right. writing about movie schedules. And she came down to offer that to me, and I said, gee, I'm afraid I'd be stuck back there. And, you know, she said, yeah, you're right to turn it down. So that was 1 year. Many years later, I tried Lou Forster on the fact-checking department, which was a well-known sort of stepping stone. One of the things Calvin Trillin says, which I think is very true about promotion at the New Yorker, is that it's not easy to climb a ladder when you don't know where the ladder is.
Well, and, that's true.
So I tried Lou Forster on the fact-checking department, which seemed to be a kind of a step forward into talk of the town mm-hmm. writing. And he said, oh, no, you're much too pretty. You'll have to be a model rather than a fact-checker.
Were you offended at the time?
I had the sense to be obscurely. I mean, I was offended, but not offended enough to throw down my purse or slap his face or do anything.
Well, this is in the 60s or
yes,
something. So it's pre really any sort of notion of feminist awakening.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you're right.
And
so there I was. I might have told a few girlfriends what Lou Forster had said, but that's about it.
Well, you know, there are people in that book who I think of as one in particular. It's a friend of mine, and he dismissed you on one occasion with in a way that wasn't kind.
He comes after Edith Oliver. Let's not let Edith Oliver.
Well, anyway, you can read the book, but it's it is clearly gender driven. The way I saw it. When I went there, the talk of the town department was almost exclusively male, with a couple of exceptions.
Jane Boutwell
mm-hmm. was a reporter, and there were other people.
She worked like a demon, though. She really.
And she was a regular. I mean, mm-hmm. but otherwise, it was what it was. I didn't think of it at the time. I went there thinking that I was an affirmative action case because I hadn't gone to Harvard, and which practically
that's
everyone
true,
else.
You had really slipped through the cracks when you were a Yalie. That's true.
Well, that was a cross that I bear, but I really would kind of try to wonder why I was hired always, and I thought that was the only explanation was let's see if this would possibly work. You know, I hadn't been a roommate of Wally Shawn's or a classmate or.
I cover that, yes.
Yeah, that was where a lot of those, but they were talented, wonderfully talented people. It's just that it was all male. And when you finally decided that it was time to leave in the late 70s, it had changed a bit by then in your mind?
Yes, I indicate that there might have been some relation between the Tom Wolfe story about the mausoleum on 43rd Street
right.
and a kind of breaking open of some of these doors. Charlene Hunter came after that, Hunter Gault now,
right.
And a couple of other African-American writers came on the scene. Alan Willis was brought on as the
rock critic.
And
then Jamaica Kincaid came
Veronica
later.
Gang. Lots of things happened, and so it was opening up.
I'm still at the New Yorker, I've lived through those. I've lived through four editorships now, and I will say that. Well, I could turn the floor over to Andrew Marantz, who's here tonight in the second row, and he's a staff editorial assistant there. And everybody there that I know, I look over my shoulder because they're all younger than I am, and they're all much, much smarter than I am. And Andrew could tell you all the ways in which I depend upon him to save me from myself. But the good news...
This is the man who wrote this brilliant piece about the elusive dentist who shaded his marathon race results.
Andrew did most of the reporting for that, too. But anyway, the point is that I will say the good news is that it is an open place now. I believe there is absolutely equal opportunity all around. It's not a private club. It's not a mysterious place. It's a meritocracy more than ever. And I think that it wasn't in those days. And I think that you were truly a victim of that. Did you see yourself that way?
Well, of course, I sum up at the end of the book with a little passage that I sometimes like to read about whether I was a victim or a beneficiary. It's only a paragraph.
You want to go ahead?
I don't know whether you'd like to hear that, but it's pretty easy to this might take a little longer because I have to get my reading glasses.
You want to borrow mine?
That any department store pair of magnified glasses will work, but I've got them. Thank you. Well, I say that I have to, before concluding this book, confront the story of my failure to advance at the magazine. Did that make me a victim or a beneficiary? It seems to me a two-way street. When the Newspaper Guild reps looked at my salary record, $80 a week to start and $163 to finish, they were incensed, and much was said about the way the magazine was exploiting me. However, as I look back on the 8 trips to Europe the magazine underwrote by way of lengthy vacations in the summers, 2 of which stretched to 8 weeks away and or more, 4 of them with pay, my 12 years of graduate school, 10 years of expensive psychoanalysis with a top Manhattan analyst. If the magazine chose to exploit my passive dependency, they paid handsomely to rid me of it. Coverage of my desk to permit a Thursday-Friday trip up to Poughkeepsie to teach a course at Vassar in 1976. As well as many intangibles that came to me in the way of invitations to share the cultural, social, and literary life of the city, and by extension, the wider world, it's not clear to me who is exploiting whom.
Well, that's a very generous and self-aware understanding. You don't have any bitterness about this at all. You wouldn't have written the book of this sort.
It's true, I don't. And if there were any lingering things about that talk story, just getting it out into the book freed me of it, so that I'm quite happy.
You remind me that I once had a talk story that I wrote about an abandoned subway station. And those kind of stories were always good. They weren't timely because there was nothing news-driven about the talk of the town section in those days, and it was a path station. It wasn't a subway station. And it was somewhere in Chelsea, and I went through with 3 different people from the Port Authority executives who showed me around. We wore miners' helmets, and it was there were the literally old movie posters or other things on the wall. You had walked into a time warp, which was really great. And so I wrote the piece, and it disappeared at the bottom of a pile of things on Mr. Sean's desk. And you never heard about anything when you turned it in, and unless if it was bought, you would get a call from him, especially with a long piece. Mr. Sean would call you and say very nice things, and you felt that you were the most important person on the staff of The New Yorker, blah, blah, blah. That was, a reward and part of the indentured nature of the relationship. It worked both ways, but in this case, it got to be summer, and everyone fled. People went to Cape Cod, or they went wherever the writers' the floors were empty in the summer. You were in England. In this case, this talk piece, I get a call from a fact checker, and they said, we're running your talk piece about this abandoned path station. And I had forgotten about it completely. It was 2 or 3 years later, and they went to do the fact checking on it, and it turned out that the two of the three people I had gone on this underground journey with were no longer with the Port Authority, and so the solution to that was to find the people who had replaced them in those jobs and insert them into the story and put in their mouths the words that these other guys had spoken. So all I can say is when you read about the vaunted New Yorker fact-checking department, they are great. They're inventive as well as accurate. And that sort of thing wouldn't pass muster nowadays. Now, that reminds me, the other sort of thing that, quote-unquote, wouldn't pass muster is the sort of unique is a terrible word to use to describe anything because it's not very descriptive, but Joseph Mitchell, who is a great friend of yours, and you write a length about him in the magazine, wrote stories that in some cases he would acknowledge that a character was a composite, but he was practicing the new journalism before Tom Wolfe and others supposedly invented it, and using novelistic techniques to write nonfiction stories. And
he told me, by the way, that sports writers had been doing that for years.
So when that's the question. So he told you that he was doing it, and what did he have to say about what he thought he was doing? What, do you recall?
Well, we talked about, was it apropos of the Alistair Reed scandal, something about letters from Spain and a mayor of a small town in Franco's Spain who was casually referred to by Alistair when a young reporter was interviewing many, many years later. He was interviewing him, and he said, well, yeah, he made that mayor up, because he needed somebody to be the spokesperson
right.
for the rebels against Franco. And there was a big to-do, and the Times found out about it.
It was in the Wall Street Journal. It was a Wall Street Journal reporter who had been in a seminar at Yale where Alistair was speaking,
yes.
and he had told this story, and this was an off-the-record conversation. And this person later dredged this up and splashed it over the front page of the Wall Street Journal, because that any opportunity to stick it to the New Yorker, anyone today still grabs.
I think the Times was not reluctant to cover the story either.
No, they grabbed it after the Journal had.
Anyhow, Joe and I were lunching, and he talked about it, and he said he was very sympathetic to Alistair's position. And the reason, and I think he may have talked about those people down on the waterfront who had been figuring in his early pieces from Lower Manhattan, from the fish market, and from the shad fishermen, and so on. And he said, feature writers have been making composites and setting the scene for good quotes, and perhaps even providing the good quotes for as long as journalism has been extant, as far as he knew. And he didn't think it was a pernicious practice in feature journalism. I suppose he would have felt differently about news, but in any case, he said many of the things that Satchel Paige was said to have said by sports writers had been wonderful inspirations of sports writers, and that's the way that went.
Right. That's a longer discussion, I'm afraid, if somebody in the audience might want to take it up. But I think that nowadays it is regarded as more pernicious than he thought it was, simply because, first of all, the distinction between news and feature writing is not one that's so simple to describe.
It's a borderline that can get blurred.
But the borderline between fact and fiction is the one we're really talking about, and it becomes Joe Mitchell was a wonderful writer, and Joe Mitchell did what he did, and he should have done what he did. He should have been allowed to do what he did. We just don't want everybody running around doing what he did if they don't have his talents and his powers of discrimination. That was one of your really most treasured friendships at the magazine.
Yes, I feel very privileged to be among the few people to whom Joe would talk about his writer's block. This is a writer who was most revered. Mark and I don't know, three decades of other New Yorker writers paid tribute to Joe in the pages of the magazine when he died, not having published there for 32 years, because of a writer's block, but everyone said wonderful things about him. And I was lunching with him through these years when he was blocked, and perhaps one of the few people to whom he would talk about what he was trying to do. And that's in the book.
Well, it's time for questions. And if your questions include, would we do the audiovisual presentation, we'll take that one up. If you have a question, don't be shy, and I hope that it is a question. Right here, Ved.
Mark, I just want to say one thing about Alistair Reed's piece. He was writing about Franco Stein, and if he had given the real name and the real place, he would have not only been in trouble, but the person he was writing about would have been in trouble.
Can everyone hear that? What Ved's saying is that Alistair Reed, when this episode occurred, was writing about Franco Spain, and at the time, the person that he was referring to, if he'd been identified, would have been in jeopardy. Do you want to add to that, Ved?
No, the only thing I want to say is that I think the strategic mistake was to talk about what was really something to do with the magazine.
Yes. Yes.
She made a big story out of it.
Right.
But I don't think any writer that I knew at the time resented Alistair for doing what he did
with. Ed's saying that he doesn't think anyone at the magazine at the time resented Alistair doing that. I don't. Well, I'll trust your memory of that. Who's next? Yes.
Would you consider yourself a slow bloomer, a late bloomer who profited from the gender prejudice as a mother?
Profited from it? Well, I suppose you could say that I'm profiting from it now. I don't think that those salary checks would indicate that I profited very much from it at the time. But about late blooming, we've all heard about late blooming. Mark very kindly, after having established my birth year, refrained from telling you, but this is ridiculous. Late blooming? Yes.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful book.
It was wonderful. And I guess, while I have you here,
yes.
I'm wondering about his writer's block. Do you think he was attracted to Gould in part because of his writer's block, or did Gould bring something out in him, or was it just the acclaim that it accompanied such a brilliant work that went into it?
Can you hear the question in the back of the room? The question is, this is a young woman who's just finished reading Joe Gould's Secret today. And it was a book that was published in 1965 or 66. And then followed this writer's block that lasted over three decades. And Joe Gould's Secret is about a writer who is supposedly writing an oral history of humanity, the world. And in fact, and Mitchell is attracted to him because this is a remarkable character. And then it turns out that Joe Gould's secret is that the the manuscript doesn't exist. He has him doing it. And you're asking whether Mitchell was attracted to Gould because he recognized himself in that and knew that a writer's block was coming, or how did you put it? After they've done one really fantastic thing, that it dries up?
For what, whatever combination of those reasons that you suggest, it's true that he, in a very eerie way, his own life after that mirrored somewhat the story that he tells of Joe Gould, that is the manuscript that is everybody is waiting for, the manuscript that everybody's looking for, and the manuscript that ultimately is never found. He was perhaps in some curious way feeling that pressure and finding it an obstacle to going forward, though he worked faithfully. Every day he came into the office and he told me that there were notes that were piling up in his drawers in his 20th floor office, not on my floor, but on his 20th floor office. And he was trying very hard to put together a couple of, I think probably unmixable stories, the story of his tobacco and cotton farming background in North Carolina, and the story of the Lower Manhattan fish market. And
you do describe that in the book. And with the New Yorker Festival a couple of weeks ago, down at the South Street Seaport, I was part of a discussion with Ian Fraser and Joe's daughter, Nora Mitchell Sanborn. And one of the things that we discussed, of course, was what was he doing? And she brought these amazing documents. It was a folder filled with lists that her father had typed. And the one that she read was a list of the things that his family had brought. His niece, I think his nephew, had brought up to New York when he came for a visit at Christmas. And it was, to say that it was detailed doesn't really do it justice, but it was descriptive of every single item that they brought. And we're talking about food items, you know, and vegetables and things that they brought from the farm and things that they've canned and then the present for a newborn baby. And he was a reporter every day of his life. He was writing things down every day. And when I wrote about this whole question at some length a few years after he died in a piece called Joe Mitchell's Secret, and I was trying to get at this question of what was he doing, and I went to see Nora Sanborn, where she lives in New Jersey, and she showed me a jar full of stuff. I mean, literally a big jar, like a gallon-sized jar, wide-mouth jar. And in it were objects, found objects, and each had wrapped around it a piece of paper. And it was a taxonomy, really, of what he was finding there. And they were described in terms of where he found them, on his farm down in North Carolina. He dug these things up. Some of them were pieces of pottery. There were Indian arrowheads. There were pieces of hardware. And he would include in his descriptions the people who lived on the property nearby where he found it. So he was writing something. I actually believe that he wrote something, not just was writing something. His literary executor recently passed away, and now his daughter is the executor, and there's Nora Sanborn is the executor, and there is a biography of of Mitchell that's being written by Thomas Kunkel. Did you speak with Kunkel?
I heard about his being authorized to do the biography just 19 days or a couple of weeks ago when I was in Minnesota, and someone who knew about it told me about it. I'm thrilled because Thomas Kunkel wrote the most wonderful biography of Harold Ross, the founder of the
And edited a book of Ross's letters. It's really a remarkable collection of that, too.
We can all look forward to the biography of Joseph Mitchell.
Questions still? A couple more?
No dealings at all, to take the second one first. He never appeared on the 18th floor. John O'Hara.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was having any relations he was having with the people who were editing fiction on the 20th floor, William Maxwell, Catherine White. To say that Harold Ross was still a faint shade around, particularly when Brendan Gill's book came out, and there was so much about Ross there. Do you know, here at The New Yorker, Brendan Gill's book was a lot about Harold Ross, and we felt the shade then. But it's true that Mr. Shawn was a very, very prominent psychic presence in all of our lives from the moment that I came, and he had already established that maybe in the two or three years since the death of Ross.
I'm just remembering this. Andrew, I need your help with this. There is a photograph of Harold Ross hanging somewhere at 4 Times Square, correct now? Is that right?
Over that couch in the middle.
It's there. There's no photograph of William Shawn hanging there, which is, make of that what you will. Yes.
Well, there is one about Charles Adams, who did trade upon his macabre reputation, that I haven't got in the book. Maybe I'll tell it. It was, when he came in every day. He was a very faithful attendee of the 18th floor, had a corner office with an antique electric chair in it in the corner. And he was always getting wonderful, glamorous invitations to dinner from people like Jackie Kennedy and a movie actress some of you may remember named Joan Fontaine. And I think she called herself Joan. Miss Fontaine called. And won't you have him call? And because he looked wonderful in a dinner jacket, and he was just lovely to be around. But he did have a kind of a sense of keeping up his reputation. He had been missing from the office from several weeks, and we came in just before closing time. I said, "Well, you know, we haven't seen you lately. Have you been ill?" He said, "No, I've been on jury duty." And I thought, well, who would put Charles Adams on a jury? They must have exhausted all of their their objections. In any case, he was on this jury, and it was a murder trial. He was there because the trial had concluded. And I said, "Well, what verdict did you bring in?" And he just grinned from ear to ear and said, "Guilty."
That's a good moment while we're still here. And I think this we can finish up with this. There are cartoons in this PowerPoint, and I'd like it if we could do this. But let's first set the stage. These are drawings that were left at your workspace when you would be out, right? And you would come back from lunch.
That's right. A New Yorker cartoonist whom I call Evan Sim, he's been misidentified as Frank Modell, and now we'll just keep calling him Evan Sim, I think. In any case, he was the man I called the great deceiver who took my virginity when I was up in the, I was that naive girl in the art department, and pretended that we were going to have beautiful children together. I mean, when a girl from Iowa doesn't go into bed with somebody and give that up for just anybody, he was certainly going to be proposing marriage any day. What I didn't know was that there was a fiancé in the wings from who came over from Austria, and never mind. Anyway, I think we can go right on through these early pictures that indicate... Oh, this is Joe Mitchell and me at the 50th anniversary party.
1975.
Right. And he wrote me a wonderful letter to suggest what we were doing. He said, "This anybody can tell these are two Bible students talking about New Testament epistles." He says that you were interpreted a certain verse in Galatians, I think it was, as seen in the light of a similar verse in 2 Thessalonians. And at the exact moment that Jill took this picture, I was letting you know how very much I admired your interpretation. Arthur Getz, a cover artist, had me sitting for him, and he put me with my little top knot with some pearls around the chignon in a movie booth, which was very interesting because I had been the child of a movie theater owner in my youth. That's where I saw all those black and white pictures of New York. Anyway, I was thrilled to be the model for that. And these are the Evan Sim soup puns. I would come in day after day. He did describe himself, and I think probably he was indicating that he thought he had been monstrous to me because he drew himself as Gargantua to Janet Gross from Gargantua. And the beginning of this series was the duck in the bowl, and naturally that's duck soup. And we're going to go on and see Admiral Byrd at the North Pole in bird's nest soup, and a tomato with quackers. The puns just got worse and worse. This is probably the worst of all. Vichyssoise. Egg drop is pretty good. He said he did wonder what a chow dog looked like before he put the chow in the door. Chowder. And this maybe needs some explanation. He thought I came from Austin, Minnesota. I went to high school in Austin, Minnesota, which is otherwise known as Spamtown, and that's why it's homemade soup.
Okay.
The sick turtle, I quite like him. And my favorite. And that's
well,
a good place to end.
That is a good place to end. Thank
Mark,
you.
Mark, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Joshua. Thank you.